Chapter 78. Poison. The roar of the Dracus was like a trumpet, if you can imagine a trumpet as big as a house, and made of stone, and thunder, and molten lead. I didn't feel it in my chest. I felt it in my feet, as the earth shook with it. The roar made us jump nearly out of our skins. The top of Denna's head banged into my nose, and I staggered, blinded with pain. Denna didn't notice as she was busy tripping and falling over into a loose, laughing tangle of arms and legs. As I helped Denna to her feet, I heard a distant crashing, and we made our way carefully back up to the lookout. The Dracus was cavorting, bounding around like a drunken dog, knocking over trees like a boy would topple corn stalks in a field. I watched breathlessly as it came to an ancient oak tree, 100 years old, and massive as a graystone. The Dracus reared up and brought its front legs down on one of the lower branches as if it wanted to climb. The branch, big as a tree itself, practically exploded. The Dracus reared again, coming down hard on the tree. I watched, certain that it was about to impale itself on the broken limb, but the jagged spear of hard wood barely dimpled its chest before splintering. The Dracus crashed into the trunk, and though it didn't snap, it fractured with a sound like a crack of lightning. The Dracus threw itself around, hopped and fell, rolling over jagged spurs of rock. It belched a huge gout of flame and charged the fractured oak tree again, striking with its great blunt wedge of a head. This time, it knocked the tree over, causing an explosion of earth and rock as the tree's roots tore out of the ground. All I could think of was the futility of trying to hurt this creature. It was bringing more force to bear against itself than I could ever hope to muster. "There's no way we can kill that," I said. "It would be like trying to attack a thunderstorm. How could we possibly hurt it?"
"We lure her over the side of a cliff," Denna said matter-of-factly.
"She?" I asked. "Why do you think it's a she?"
"Why do you think it's a he?" she replied, then shook her head as if to clear it. "Never mind. It doesn't matter. We know it's drawn to fires. We just build one and hang it from a branch." She pointed to a few trees overhanging the cliff below. "Then, when it rushes over to put it out..." She made a pantomime with both hands of something falling.
"Do you think even that would hurt it?" I asked dubiously.
"Well," Denna said, "when you flick an ant off a table, it doesn't get hurt, even though for an ant that has to be like dropping off a cliff. But if one of us jumped off a roof, we'd get hurt because we're heavier. It makes sense that bigger things fall even harder." She gave a pointed look down at the Dracus. "You don't get much bigger than that." She was right, of course. She was talking about the square-cube ratio, though she didn't know what to call it.
"It should at least injure it," Denna continued. "Then, I don't know, we could roll rocks down onto it or something."
She looked at me.
"What? Is there something wrong with my idea?"
"It's not very heroic," I said dismissively. "I was expecting something with a little more flair."
"Well, I left my armor and warhorse at home," she said. "You're just upset because your big university brain couldn't think of a way, and my plan is brilliant."
She pointed behind us to the Box Canyon.
"We'll build the fire in one of those metal pans. They're wide and shallow, and they'll take the heat. Was there any rope in that shed?"
I felt the familiar sinking feeling in my gut.
"No, I don't think so."
Denna patted me on the arm.
"Don't look like that.
When it leaves, we'll check on the wreckage of the house. I'll bet there's some rope in there."
She looked at the Dracus. "Honestly, I know how she feels. I feel a little like running around and jumping on things, too."
"That's the mania I was talking about," I said. After a quarter hour, the Dracus left the valley. Only then did Denna and I emerge from our hiding place, me carrying my travel sack, she with the heavy oilskin bag that held all the resin we'd found. Nearly a full bushel of it.
"Give me your lodestone," she said, setting down the sack. I handed it over. "You find some rope.
I'm going to go get you a present. She skipped away lightly, her dark hair flying behind her. I made a quick search of the house, holding my breath as much as possible. I found a hatchet, broken crockery, a barrel of wormy flour, a mildewy straw tick, and a ball of twine, but no rope. Denna gave a delighted shout from the trees, ran up to me, and pressed a black scale into my hand. It was warm with the sun, slightly larger than hers, but more oval than tear-shaped. "Thank you kindly, m'lady." She bobbed a charming curtsy, grinning. "Rope?" I held up a ball of rough twine. "This is as close as I could find. Sorry." Denna frowned, then shrugged it off. "Oh, well. Your turn for a plan. You have any strange, wonderful magics from the university? Any dark powers better left alone?" I turned the scale over in my hands and thought about it. I had wax, and this scale would make as good a link as any hair. I could make a simulacrum of the Dracus, but then what? A hot foot wasn't going to bother a creature that was perfectly comfortable lying on a bed of coals. But there are more sinister things you can do with a Mommet. Things no good arcanist was ever supposed to consider. Things with pins and knives that would leave a man bleeding even though he was miles away. True malfeasance. I looked at the scale in my hand, considering it. The thing was mostly iron and thicker than my palm in the middle. Even with a Mommet and a hot fire for energy, I didn't know if I could make it through the scales to hurt the thing. Worst of all, if I tried, I wouldn't know if it had worked. I couldn't bear the thought of sitting idly by some fire, sticking pins into a wax doll, while miles away a drug-crazed Dracus rolled in the flaming wreckage of some innocent family's farm. "No," I said. "No magic I can think of." "We can go tell the constable that he needs to deputize about a dozen men with bows to come and kill a drug-crazed big-as-a-house dragon chicken." It came to me in a flash. "Poison," I said. "We'll have to poison it." "You've got 2 quarts of arsenic on you?" she asked skeptically. "Would that even be enough for something big as that?" "Not arsenic." I nudged the oilskin sack with my foot. She looked down. "Oh," she said, crestfallen. "What about my pony?" "You'll probably have to skip your pony," I said. "But we'll still have enough to buy you a half-harp. In fact, I bet we'll be able to make even more money from the Dracus's body. The scales will be worth a lot. And the naturalists at the university will love to be able—" "You don't need to sell me," she said. "I know it's the right thing to do." She looked up at me and grinned. "Besides, we get to be heroes and kill the dragon. Its treasure is just a perk." I laughed. "Right then," I said. "I think we should head back to the Greystone Hill and build a fire there to lure it in." Denna looked puzzled. "Why? We know it's going to come back here. Why don't we just camp here and wait?" I shook my head. "Look at how many Denner trees are left." She looked around. "It ate all of them?" I nodded. "If we kill it this evening, we can be back in Traben by tonight," I said. "I'm tired of sleeping outdoors. I want to get a bath, a hot meal, and a real bed." "You're lying again," she said cheerfully. "Your delivery's getting better, but to me, you're clear as a shallow stream." She prodded my chest with a finger. "Tell me the truth." "I want to get you back to Traben," I said, "just in case you ate more resin than is good for you. I wouldn't trust any doctor living there, but they probably have some medicines I could use, just in case." "My hero," Denna smiled. "You're sweet, but I feel fine." I reached out and flicked her ear with the tip of my finger, hard. Her hand went to the side of her head, her expression outraged. "Ow!" "Oh." She looked confused. "Doesn't hurt at all, does it?" "No," she said. "Here is the truth," I said seriously. "I think you're going to be fine, but I don't know for certain. I don't know how much of that stuff you have left working its way into your system. In an hour, I'll have a better idea. But if something goes wrong, I'd rather be an hour closer to Traben. It means I won't have to carry you as far. I looked her square in the eye. I don't gamble with the lives of people I care for. She listened to me, her expression somber. Then the grin blossomed back onto her face. I like your manly bravado, she said. Do it some more.
Chapter 79, Sweet Talk. It took us about 2 hours to get back to the Greystone Hill. It would have been faster, but Denna's mania was growing stronger, and all her extra energy was more of a hindrance than a help. She was highly distractible and prone to larking off in her own direction if she saw something interesting. We crossed the same small stream that we had before, and, despite the fact that it wasn't much more than ankle deep, Denna insisted on bathing. I washed up a little, then moved a discreet distance away and listened to her sing several rather racy songs. She also made several none-too-subtle invitations that I could join her in the water. Needless to say, I kept my distance. There are names for people who take advantage of women who are not in full control of themselves, and none of those names will ever rightfully be applied to me. Once we reached the peak of the Greystone Hill, I put Denna's surplus of energy to use and sent her to gather firewood while I made an even larger fire pit than our previous one. The bigger the fire, the quicker it would draw the Dracus close. I sat down next to the oilskin bag and opened it. The resin gave off an earthy smell, like sweet, smoky mulch. Denna returned to the top of the hill and dropped an armload of wood.
How much of that are you going to use? She asked.
I still have to figure that out, I said. It's going to require some guesswork.
Just give him all of it, Denna said. Better safe than sorry.
I shook my head. There's no reason to go that far. It would just be wasteful. Besides, the resin makes a powerful painkiller when properly refined.
People could use the medicine, and you could use the money, Denna said.
I could, I admitted. But honestly, I was thinking more about your harp. You lost your lyre in that fire. I know what it's like to be without an instrument.
Did you ever hear the story about the boy with the golden arrows? Denna asked. That always bothered me when I was young. You must want to kill someone really badly to shoot a gold arrow at him. Why not just keep the gold and go home?
It certainly shines a new light on that story, I said, looking down at the sack. I guess this much Denna resin would be worth at least 50 talents to an apothecary. Maybe as much as 100, depending on how refined it was. Denna shrugged and headed back into the trees for more firewood, and I began the elaborate guesswork of how much Denna it would take to poison a 5-ton lizard. It was a nightmare of educated guessery, complicated by the fact that I had no way to make accurate measurements. I started with a bead the size of the last digit of my little finger. My guess as to how much resin Denna had actually swallowed. However, Denna had been liberally dosed with charcoal, which effectively reduced that by half. I was left with a ball of black resin slightly larger than a pea. But that was just the amount required to make a human girl euphoric and energetic. I wanted to kill the Dracus. For that, I tripled the dose, then tripled it again to be sure. The end result was a ball the size of a large, ripe grape. I guessed the Dracus weighed 5 tons. 800 stone. I guessed Denna at 8 or 9 stone. 8 to be on the safe side. That meant I needed 100 times that grape-sized dose to kill the Dracus. I made 10 grape-sized pellets, then mashed them together. It was the size of an apricot. I made 9 more apricot-sized balls and set them in the wooden bucket we had brought from the Denner plantation. Denna dropped another load of wood and peered down into the bucket.
That's it? She asked. It doesn't look like very much. She was right.
It didn't look like much at all compared to the Dracus's huge bulk. I explained how I'd come up with my estimate. She nodded.
That seems about right, I guess. But don't forget that it's been eating trees for the better part of a month. It probably has a tolerance.
I nodded and added 5 more apricot-sized balls to the bucket.
And it might be tougher than you think. The resin might work different on lizards.
I nodded again and added another 5 balls to the bucket. Then, after a moment's consideration, I added one more.
That brings us up to 21, I explained. A good number. 3 7s.
Nothing wrong with having luck on your side, Denna agreed.
We want it to die quickly, too, I said. It will be more humane for the Dracus and safer for us.
Denna looked at me.
So we double it.
I nodded, and she headed back into the trees while I made another 21 balls and dropped them into the bucket. She came back with more wood just as I was rolling up the last ball. I packed the resin down into the bottom of the bucket.
That should be more than enough, I said.
That much O'Fallon would kill the entire population of Traben twice over.
Denna and I looked at the bucket.
It contained about 1/3 of all the resin we'd found. What was left in the oilskin sack would be enough to buy Denna a half-harp, pay off my debt to Devi, and still have enough left over so that we could live comfortably for months. I thought of buying new clothes, a full set of new strings for my lute, a bottle of Avenish fruit wine. I thought of the Dracus brushing aside trees as if they were sheaves of wheat, shattering them casually with its weight.
We should double it again, Denna said, echoing my own thoughts. Just to be sure.
I doubled it yet again, rolling out another 42 balls of the resin while Denna fetched armload after armload of wood. I got the fire blazing just as the rain started to come down. We built it larger than our last one, with the hope that a brighter fire would attract the Dracus more quickly. I wanted to get Denna back to the relative safety of Traben as soon as possible. Lastly, I cobbled together a rough ladder using the hatchet and twine I'd found. It was ugly, but serviceable, and I leaned it up against the side of the graystone arch. This time, Denna and I would have an easy route to safety. Our dinner was nowhere near as grand as last night's. We made do with the last of my now stale flatbread, dried meat, and the last potatoes baked on the edge of the fire. While we ate, I told Denna the full story of the fire in the fishery, partly because I was young and male and desperately wanted to impress her, but I also wanted to make it clear that I had missed our lunch due to circumstances completely outside my control. She was the perfect audience, attentive and gasping at all the right moments. I was no longer worried about her overdosing. After gathering a small mountain of firewood, her mania was fading, leaving her in a content, almost dreamy lethargy. Still, I knew the after effects of the drug would leave her exhausted and weak. I wanted her safely in bed in Traben for her recovery. After we finished eating, I made my way over to where she sat with her back against one of the graystones. I cuffed up my shirt sleeves.
All right, I need to check you over, I said pompously.
She smiled lazily at me, her eyes half closed.
You really do know how to sweet-talk a girl, don't you?
I felt for her pulse in the hollow of her slender throat. It was slow, but steady. She shied away a little from my touch.
You tickle.
How do you feel? I asked.
Tired, she said, her voice slightly slurred. Good and tired and a little cold.
While this wasn't unexpected, it was still a little surprising considering the fact that we were only feet away from a blazing bonfire. I fetched the extra blanket from my bag and brought it back to her. She snuggled into it. I leaned close so that I could look into her eyes. Her pupils were still wide and sluggish, but no more than before. She reached up and lay her hand on my cheek.
You have the sweetest face, she said, looking at me dreamily. It's like the perfect kitchen.
I fought not to smile. This was the delirium. She'd fade in and out of it before the profound exhaustion dragged her down into unconsciousness.
If you see someone spouting nonsense to themselves in an alley in Tarbiyan, odds are they're not actually crazy, just a sweet-eater deranged by too much dinner.
A kitchen?
Yes, she said. Everything matches and the sugar bowl is right where it should be.
How does it feel when you breathe? I asked.
Normal, she said easily. Tight, but normal.
My heart beat a little faster at that. What do you mean by that?
I have trouble breathing, she said. My chest gets tight sometimes, and it's like breathing through pudding.
She laughed.
Did I say pudding? I meant molasses. Like a sweet molasses pudding.
I fought off the urge to point out angrily that I'd asked her to tell me if she felt anything wrong with her breathing. Is it hard to breathe now? She shrugged indifferently. I need to listen to your breathing, I said. But I don't have any tools here, so if you could unbutton your shirt a little, I'll need to press my ear against your chest. Denna rolled her eyes and unbuttoned more of her shirt than was altogether necessary.
Now that one is entirely new, she said archly, sounding for a moment like her normal self. I've never had anyone try that before.
I turned and pressed my ear up against her breastbone.
What does my heart sound like? She asked.
It's slow but strong, I said. It's a good heart.
Is it saying anything?
Nothing I can hear, I said.
Listen harder.
Take a few deep breaths and don't talk, I said. I need to listen to your breathing. I listened. The air rushed in, and I felt one of her breasts pressing against my arm. She exhaled, and I felt her breath warm against the back of my neck. Goose flesh broke out over my whole body. I could picture Arwel's disapproving stare. I closed my eyes and tried to concentrate on what I was doing. In and out. It was like listening to the wind through the trees. In and out. I could hear a faint crackling, like paper crumpling. Like a faint sigh. But there was no wetness. No bubbling.
Your hair smells really nice, she said.
I sat up. You're fine, I said. Make sure to let me know if it gets any worse or feels different. She nodded amiably, smiling dreamily. Irritated that the Drakus seemed to be taking its sweet time making an appearance, I heaped more wood on the fire. I looked out at the northern bluffs, but there was nothing to see in the dim light but the outlines of trees and rocks. Denna laughed suddenly.
Did I call your face a sugar bowl or something? She asked, peering at me. Am I even making any sense right now?
It's just a little delirium, I reassured her. You'll fade in and out of it before you go to sleep.
I hope it's as much fun for you as it is for me, she said, pulling the blanket closer around herself. It's like a cottony dream, but not as warm.
I climbed the ladder to the top of the graystone, where we had stashed our possessions. I took a handful of the Denner resin out of the oilskin sack, carried it down, and threw it on the edge of the fire. It burned sullenly, giving off an acrid smoke that the wind brushed away to the north and west, toward the unseen bluffs. Hopefully, the Drakus would smell it and come running.
I had pneumonia when I was just a tiny baby, Dennis said with no particular inflection. That's why my lungs aren't good. It's horrible not being able to breathe sometimes.
Denna's eyes were half closed as she continued, almost as if she were talking to herself.
I stopped breathing for 2 minutes and died. Sometimes I wonder if this all isn't some sort of mistake, if I should be dead. But if it isn't a mistake, I have to be here for a reason. But if there is a reason, I don't know what that reason is.
There was the distinct possibility that she didn't even realize that she was talking, and an even greater possibility that most of the important parts of her brain were already asleep and she wouldn't remember any of what was happening now in the morning. Since I didn't know how to respond, I simply nodded.
That's the first thing you said to me. I was just wondering why you're here. My 7 words. I've been wondering the same thing for so long.
The sun, already hidden by the clouds, finally set behind the western mountains. As the landscape faded into darkness, the top of this small hill felt like an island in a great ocean of night.
Denna was beginning to nod where she sat, her head slowly sinking to her chest, then bobbing back up. I walked over and held out my hand.
Come on. The Dracus will be here soon. We should get up onto the stones.
She nodded and came to her feet, blankets still wrapped around her. I followed her to the ladder, and she made her slow, stumbling way up to the top of the graystone. It was chilly up on the stone, away from the fire. The wind brushed past, making the slight chill worse. I spread one blanket across the stone, and she sat down, huddled in the other blanket. The cold seemed to rouse her a little, and she looked around peevishly, shivering.
"Damn chicken! Come eat your dinner, I'm cold!"
"I was hoping to have you tucked into a warm bed in Traben by now," I admitted. "So much for my brilliant plan."
"You always know where you're doing," she said muzzily. "You're important with your green eyes looking at me like I mean something. It's okay that you have better things to do. It's enough that I get you sometimes. Once in a while. I know I'm lucky for that. To get you just a little."
I nodded agreeably as I watched the hillside for signs of the Dracus. We sat for a while longer, staring off into the dark. Denna nodded a little, then pulled herself upright again and fought off another violent shiver.
"I know you don't think of me," she trailed off.
It's best to humor people in delirium, lest they turn violent.
"I think about you all the time, Denna," I said. "Don't patronize me," she said crossly, then her tone softened again. "You don't think of me like that. That's fine. But if you're cold too, you could come over here and put your arms around me, just a little."
My heart in my mouth, I moved closer and sat behind her, wrapping my arms around her.
"That's nice," she said, relaxing. "I feel like I've always been cold."
We sat looking to the north. She leaned against me, delightful in my arms. I drew shallow breaths, not wanting to disturb her. Denna stirred slightly, murmuring,
"You're so gentle. You never push."
She trailed off again, resting more heavily against my chest. Then she roused herself.
"You could, you know, push more. Just a little."
I sat there in the dark, holding her sleeping body in my arms. She was soft and warm, indescribably precious. I had never held a woman before. After a few moments, my back began to ache with the pressure of supporting her weight and my own. My legs started to go numb. Her hair tickled my nose. Still, I didn't move for fear of ruining this, the most wonderful moment of my life. Denna shifted in her sleep, then started to slide sideways and jerked awake.
"Lie down,"
she said, her voice clear again. She fumbled with the blanket, pulling it away so it was no longer between us.
"Come on, you've got to be cold too. You're not a priest, so you're not going to get in trouble for it. We'll be fine, just a little fine in the cold."
I put my arms around her, and she draped the blanket over both of us. We lay on our sides, like spoons nesting in a drawer. My arm ended up under her head like a pillow. She curled snugly along the inside of my body, so easy and natural, as if she had been designed to fit there. As I lay there, I realized I had been wrong before. This was the most wonderful moment of my life. Denna stirred in her sleep.
"I know you didn't mean it," she said clearly.
"Mean what?" I asked softly. Her voice was different, no longer dreamy and tired. I wondered if she was talking in her sleep.
Before, you said you'd knock me down and make me eat coals. You'd never hit me.
She turned her head a little.
You wouldn't, would you? Not even if it was for my own good.
I felt a chill go through me.
What do you mean?
There was a long pause, and I was beginning to think she'd fallen asleep when she spoke up again.
I didn't tell you everything. I know Ash didn't die at the farm. When I was heading toward the fire, he found me. He came back and said that everyone was dead. He said that people would be suspicious if I was the only one who survived.
I felt a hard, dark anger rise up in me. I knew what came next, but I let her talk. I didn't want to hear it, but I knew she needed to tell someone.
He didn't just do it out of the blue, she said. He made sure it was what I really wanted. I knew it wouldn't look convincing if I did it to myself. He made sure I really wanted him to. He made me ask him to hit me, just to be sure.
And he was right. She didn't move at all as she spoke.
Even this way, they thought I had something to do with it. If he hadn't done it, I might be in jail right now. They would have hanged me.
My stomach churned acid. Denna, I said, a man who could do that to you.
He's not worth your time. Not one moment of it. It's not a matter of him being only half a loaf. He's rotten through. You deserve better.
Who knows what I deserve, she said. He's not my best loaf. He's it. Him or hungry.
You have other options, I said, then stalled, thinking of my conversation with Diak.
I've got you, she said dreamily. I could hear the warm, sleepy smile in her voice, like a child tucked into bed.
Will you be my dark-eyed prince gallant and protect me from pigs, sing to me, whisk me away to tall trees?
She trailed off to nothing.
I will, I said, but I could tell by the heavy weight of her against my arm that she had finally fallen asleep.
Chapter 80, Touching Iron. I lay awake, feeling Denna's gentle breath against my arm. I couldn't have slept even if I'd wanted to. The closeness of her filled me with a crackling energy, a low warmth, a gentle, thrumming hum. I lay awake savoring it, every moment precious as a jewel. Then I heard the distant crack of a breaking branch. Then another. Earlier I wanted nothing more than the Drakus to hurry to our fire. Now I would have traded my right hand to have it go on its merry way for another 5 minutes. Still, it came. I began gently untangling myself from Denna. She barely stirred in her sleep.
Denna?
I shook her gently, then harder.
Nothing.
I wasn't surprised. There are few things deeper than a sweet eater's sleep. I covered her in the blanket, then set my travel sack on one side, the oilskin bag on the other, like bookends. If she rolled in her sleep, she would butt into those before getting close to the edge of the graystone. I moved to the other side of the stone and looked out to the north. The clouds were still thick overhead, so I couldn't see anything outside the circle of firelight. Feeling carefully with my fingers, I located the piece of twine I had laid across the top of the graystone. The other end was tied to the rope handle of the wooden bucket below, midway between the fire and the graystones. My main fear was that the Drakus might accidentally crush the bucket before it smelled it. I planned to haul the bucket to safety if that happened, then cast it out again. Denna had laughed at my plan, referring to it as chicken fishing. The Drakus came to the top of the hill, moving noisily through the brush. It stopped just inside the circle of firelight. Its dark eyes shone red, and there was red on its scales. It made a deep huffing sound and began to circle the fire, slowly rocking its head back and forth. It blew a wide plume of fire in what I was coming to recognize as either some sort of greeting or a challenge. It darted toward our fire. Despite the fact that I'd watched it at some length, I was still surprised by how quickly the huge animal could move. It pulled up short of the fire, huffed again, then advanced on the bucket. Despite the fact that the bucket was sturdy wood and built to hold at least 2 gallons, it looked tiny as a teacup next to the Dracus's massive head. It sniffed again, then butted the bucket with its nose, tipping it over. The bucket rolled in a half circle, but I'd packed the sticky resin in tightly. The Dracus took another step, huffed again, then took the whole thing into its mouth. I was so relieved that I almost forgot to let go of the twine. It was jerked out of my hands as the Dracus chewed the bucket a little, crushing it in its massive jaws. Then it worked its head up and down, forcing the sticky mass down its gullet. I breathed a huge sigh of relief and sat down to watch as the Dracus circled the fire. It gushed out a billow of blue flame, then another, then turned and rolled in the fire, wriggling and crushing it into the dirt. Once the fire was flattened, the Dracus began to follow the same pattern as before. It sought out the scattered pieces of the fire, rolled in them until they were extinguished, then ate the wood. I could almost imagine each new stick and stump it swallowed, forcing the denner resin deeper into its gizzard, mixing it around, breaking it up, forcing it to dissolve. A quarter hour passed as I watched it complete its circuit of the fire. I'd hoped it would have showed the effects of the resin by now. By my best guess, it had eaten 6 times a lethal dose. It should rush quickly past the initial stages of euphoria and mania. Then would follow delirium, paralysis, coma, and death. By all my calculations, it should be over within an hour, hopefully sooner. I felt a pang of regret as I watched it go about the business of crushing out the scattered fires. It was a magnificent animal. I hated to kill it even more than I hated to waste upwards of 60 talents worth of Ophalum. But there was no denying what would happen if events were left to run their course. I didn't want the deaths of innocents on my conscience. Soon it stopped eating. It merely rolled on the scattered branches, extinguishing them. It was moving more vigorously now, a sign that the denner was beginning to take effect. It started to grunt, low and deep.
Grunt, grunt.
A wash of blue fire. Roll.
Grunt.
Roll. Finally, there was nothing left but the bed of glimmering coals. As before, the Dracus positioned itself on top of them and laid down, extinguishing all the light on the top of the hill. It lay there quietly for a moment, then grunted again.
Grunt, grunt.
Wash of fire. It wriggled its belly further into the coals, almost like it was fidgeting. If this was the onset of mania, it was coming too slowly for my liking. I'd hoped that it would be well on its way to delirium by now. Had I underestimated the dosage? As my eyes slowly adjusted to the dark, I realized there was another source of light. At first, I thought the clouds had blown over and the moon was peering in from the horizon. But when I turned away from the Dracus to look behind me, I saw the truth. Off to the southwest, barely 2 miles away, Traben was full of firelight. Not just dim candlelight from windows. There were tall flames leaping everywhere. For a moment, I thought the city was ablaze. Then I realized what was happening. The Harvest Festival. There was a tall bonfire in the middle of town, and smaller ones outside the houses where people would be giving cider to the weary workers. They would drink and throw their shamblemen into the fires. Dummies made of wheat sheaves, of barley shocks, of straw, of chaff. Dummies built to flare up bright and sudden, a ritual to celebrate the end of the year, something that was supposed to keep demons away. Behind me, I heard the Dracus grunt. I looked down at it. Just as I had been, it was facing away from Traben, toward the dark cliffs to the north. I am not a religious person, but I will admit that I prayed then. I prayed earnestly to Telu and all his angels, asking for the Drakus to die, just slide quietly asleep and pass on without turning around to see the city's fires. I waited for several long minutes. At first, I thought the Drakus was asleep, but as my eyes sharpened, I could see its head weaving steadily back and forth, back and forth. As my eyes grew more accustomed to the dark, the fires of Traben seemed to grow brighter. It had been half an hour since it had eaten the resin. Why wasn't it dead yet? I wanted to throw down the rest of the resin, but I didn't dare. If the Drakus turned toward me, it would be facing south, toward the town. Even if I threw the sack of resin directly in front of it, it might turn around and resettle itself on the fire. Perhaps if... The Drakus roared then, deep and powerful as before. I had no doubt they heard it in Traben. I wouldn't have been surprised to learn that they heard it in Imre. I glanced at Denna. She shifted in her sleep, but didn't wake. The Drakus bounded off the bed of coals, looking for all the world like a frisking puppy. The coals still glimmered in places, giving me enough light to see the great beast roll around, flip, bite at the air, turn. No, I said. No, no, no! It looked out toward Traben. I could see the leaping flames of the town's fires reflected in its huge eyes. It breathed another gout of blue fire in a high arc, the same gesture it had made before, a greeting or a challenge. Then it was running, tearing down the hillside with demented abandon. I heard it crashing and snapping through the trees. Another roar. I thumbed on my sympathy lamp and went to Denna, shaking her roughly. Denna! Denna! You have to get up! She barely stirred. I lifted her eyelids and checked her pupils. They showed none of their earlier sluggishness and shrank quickly in response to the light. That meant the Denna resin had finally worked its way out of her system. This was simple exhaustion, nothing else. Just to be sure, I lifted both lids and brought the light back around again. Yes. Her pupils were fine. She was fine. As if to confirm my opinion, Denna scowled fiercely and squirmed away from the light, muttering something indistinct and decidedly unladylike. I couldn't make out all of it, but the words whoremonger and sod off were used more than once. I scooped her up, blankets and all, and carefully made my way down to the ground. I bundled her up again between the arch of the gray stones. She seemed to rouse herself slightly as I jostled her around. Denna?
Motev?
She muttered around a mouthful of sleep, her eyes barely moving under her lids. Denna! The Drakus is going down to Traben. I have to... I stopped, partly because it was obvious she had dropped back into unconsciousness, but also because I wasn't entirely sure what it was I had to do. I had to do something. Normally, the Drakus would avoid a town, but drug-crazed and manic, I had no idea what its reaction to the harvest fires would be. If it rampaged through the town, it would be my fault. I had to do something. I dashed to the top of the graystone, grabbed both bags, and came back down. I upended the travel sack, emptying everything onto the ground. I grabbed the crossbow bolts, wrapped them in my torn shirt, and stuffed them into my travel sack. I threw in the hard iron scale, too, then stuffed the bottle of brand into the oilskin sack for padding, and put that in my travel sack as well. My mouth was dry, so I took a quick swallow of water from the waterskin, recapped it, and left it for Denna. She would be terribly thirsty when she woke up. I slung the travel sack over my shoulder and cinched it tight across my back. Then I thumbed on my sympathy lamp, picked up the hatchet, and began to run. I had a dragon to kill. I ran madly through the woods, the light from my sympathy lamp bobbing wildly, revealing obstacles ahead of me bare moments before I was on top of them. Small wonder that I fell, tumbling down the hill, ass over tea kettle. When I got up, I easily found my lamp, but I abandoned the hatchet, knowing deep in my heart that it wouldn't be of any use against the Drakus. I fell twice more before I made it to the road. Then I tucked my head like a sprinter and ran toward the distant light of the city. I knew the Dracus could move faster than me, but I hoped it would be slowed by the trees, or disoriented. If I made it to the town first, I could warn them, get them ready. But as the road emerged from the trees, I could see the fires were brighter, wilder. Houses were burning. I could hear the Dracus's near-constant bellowing, punctuated by shouts and high-pitched screams. I slowed to a trot as I came into town, catching my breath. Then I scampered up the side of a house to one of the few two-story rooftops so I could see what was really happening. In the town square, the bonfire had been scattered everywhere. Several nearby houses and shops were staved in like rotten barrels, most of them burning fitfully. Fire flickered on the wooden shingles of a handful of roofs. If not for the evening's earlier rain, the town would already be ablaze instead of just a few scattered buildings. Still, it was just a matter of time. I couldn't see the Dracus, but I could hear the great crunching it made as it rolled in the wreckage of a burning house. I saw a gush of blue flame rise high above the rooftops and heard it roar again. The sound made me sweat. Who knew what was going through its drug-addled mind right now? There were people everywhere. Some were simply standing, confused. Others panicked and ran to the church, hoping to find shelter in the tall stone building or the huge iron wheel that hung there, promising them safety from demons. But the church doors were locked, and they were forced to find shelter elsewhere. Some people watched, horrified and weeping, from their windows, but a surprising number kept their heads and were forming a bucket line from the town cistern atop the city hall to a nearby burning building. And just like that, I knew what I had to do. It was like I had suddenly stepped onto a stage. Fear and hesitation left me. All that remained was for me to play my part. I jumped to a nearby roof, then made my way across several others until I came to a house near the town square where a scattered piece of bonfire had set the roof burning. I pried up a thick shingle burning along one edge and took off running for the roof of the town hall. I was only two roofs away when I slipped. Too late, I realized I'd jumped to the inn's roof. No wood shingles here, but clay tiles slippery with rain. I held tight to the burning shingle as I fell, unwilling to let it go to brace my fall. I slid nearly to the edge of the roof before I came to a stop, heart pounding. Breathless, I kicked off my boots as I lay there. Then, with the familiar feel of rooftop under my calloused feet, I ran, jumped, ran, slid, and jumped again. Finally, I swung myself one-handed by an eavepipe onto the flat stone roof of the town hall. Still clutching the burning shingle, I made my way up the ladder to the top of the cistern, whispering a breathless thanks to whoever had left it open to the sky. As I sprinted across the rooftops, the flame on the shingle had gone out, leaving a thin line of red ember along the edge. I puffed it carefully back to life, and soon it was blazing merrily again. I broke it down the middle and dropped half to the flat roof below. Turning to survey the town, I made note of the biggest fires. There were six especially bad ones, blazing up into the dark sky. Elxadal had always said that all fires are one fire, and all fires are the sympathists to command. Very well, then. All fires were one fire. This fire. This piece of burning shingle. I murmured a binding and focused my ailer. I used my thumbnail to scratch a hasty ool rune into the wood, then dock, then pessin. In the brief moment it took to do that, the entire shingle was smoldering and smoking, hot in my hand. I hooked my foot around the ladder rung and leaned deep into the cistern, quenching the shingle in the water. For a brief moment, I felt the cool water surround my hand, then it quickly warmed. Even though the shingle was underwater, I could see the faint line of red ember still smoldering along its edge. I pulled out my pocket knife with my other hand and drove it through the shingle into the wooden wall of the cistern, pinning my makeshift piece of sigildry under the water. I have no doubt it was the quickest, most slapdash heat-eater ever created. Pulling myself back onto the ladder, I looked around to a town blessedly dark. The flames had dimmed, and in most places had subsided to sullen coals. I hadn't doused the fires, merely slowed them down enough to give the townsfolk and their buckets a fighting chance. But my job was only half done. I dropped to the roof and picked up the other half of the still-burning shingle I'd dropped. Then I slid down a drainpipe and legged it away through the dark streets, across the town square to the front of the Talin Church. I stopped under the huge oak that stood before the front door, still holding its full array of autumn leaves. Kneeling, I opened my travel sack and brought out the oilskin bag with all the remaining resin. I poured the bottle of brand onto it and set it afire with the burning shingle. It flared up quickly, billowing acrid, sweet-smelling smoke. Then I put the blunt end of the shingle between my teeth, jumped to catch a low branch, then began to climb the tree. It was easier than making my way up the side of a building, and took me high enough to where I could jump to the wide stone window ledge on the church's second floor. I broke off a twig from the oak tree and stuffed it into my pocket. I edged along the window ledge to where the huge iron wheel hung, bolted to the stone of the wall. Climbing that was quicker than a ladder, though the iron spokes were startlingly cold against my still wet hands. I made my way to the top of the wheel, and from there pulled myself onto the flat peak of the highest roof in town. The fires were still dark for the most part, and most of the shouting had died down to sobs and low murmur of urgent, hurried talk. I took the piece of shingle out of my mouth and blew on it until it was flaming again. Then I concentrated, muttered another binding, and held the oak twig above the flame. I looked out over the town and saw the glimmering coals dim even further. A moment passed. The oak tree below burst into sudden brilliant flame. It flared brighter than 1,000 torches as all its leaves caught fire at the same time. In the sudden light, I saw the Dracus raise its head 2 streets away. It bellowed and blew a cloud of blue flame even as it started to run toward the fire. It turned a corner too quickly and caromed wildly into the wall of a shop, smashing through with little resistance. It slowed as it approached the tree, blowing flame again and again. The leaves flared and faded quickly, leaving nothing but 1,000 embers, making the tree look like an immense extinguished candelabrum. In the dim red light, the Dracus was hardly more than a shadow, but I could still see the beast's attention wander now that the bright flames were gone. The massive wedge of a head swayed back and forth, back and forth. I cursed under my breath. It wasn't close enough. Then the Dracus huffed loud enough for me to hear from where I stood 100 feet above. The head snapped around as it smelled the sweet smoke of the burning resin. It snuffed, grunted, and took another step toward the smoking bag of resin. It didn't show nearly the restraint it had earlier, and practically pounced on it, snapping up the smoldering sack in its great wide mouth. I took a deep breath and shook my head, trying to clear away some of the sluggishness I felt. I had performed 2 rather substantial pieces of sympathy in quick succession and was feeling rather thick-headed because of it. But as they say, third time pays for all. I broke my mind into 2 pieces, then, with some difficulty, into a third. Nothing less than a triple binding would do for this. As the Dracus worked its jaw, trying to swallow the sticky mass of resin, I fumbled in my travel sack for the heavy black scale, then brought the lodestone out from my cloak. I spoke my bindings clearly and focused my ailer. I brought the scale and stone up in front of me until I could feel them tugging at each other. I concentrated, focused. I let go of the lodestone. It shot toward the iron scale. Below my feet was an explosion of stone as the great iron wheel tore free from the church wall. A ton of wrought iron fell. If anyone had been watching, they would have noticed that the wheel fell faster than gravity could account for. They would have noticed that it fell at an angle, almost as if it were drawn to the Dracus. Almost as if Talu himself steered it toward the beast with a vengeful hand. But there was no one there to see the truth of things, and there was no god guiding it, only me. Chapter 81. Pride.
Looking down, I saw the Dracus pinned beneath the great wrought-iron wheel. It lay motionless and dark in front of the church, and despite the necessity of it, I felt a pang of regret for killing the poor beast. I had one long moment of exhausted, pure relief. The autumn air was fresh and sweet despite the wood smoke, and the stone roof of the church was cool under my feet. Feeling rather smug, I tucked the scale and the lodestone back into my travel sack. I drew a deep breath and looked out over the town I had saved. Then I heard a grating noise and felt the roof shift beneath me. The front of the building sagged, crumbled, and I staggered as the world fell out from underneath me. I looked for a safe roof to leap to, but there were none close enough. I scrambled backward as the roof disintegrated into a mass of falling rubble. Desperate, I leaped for the charred branches of the oak tree. I grabbed one, but it snapped under my weight. I tumbled through the branches, struck my head, and fell into darkness. Chapter 82. Ash and Elm. I awoke in a bed. In a room. In an inn. More than that was not immediately clear to me. I felt exactly like someone had hit me in the head with a church. I had been cleaned and bandaged, very thoroughly bandaged. Someone had seen fit to treat all my recent injuries, no matter how minor. I had white linen around my head, my chest, my knee, and one of my feet. Someone had even cleaned and wrapped the mild abrasion on my hands and the knife wound from 3 days ago when Ambrose's thugs had tried to kill me. The lump on my head had seemed to be the worst of the lot. It throbbed and left me dizzy when I lifted my head. Moving was a lesson in punitive anatomy. I swung my feet off the edge of the bed and grimaced. Deep tissue trauma to the medial pulmonoid in the right leg. I sat up. Oblique strain to the cartilage between the lower ribs. I got to my feet. Minor spraining in the sub... trans... damn. What was that called? I pictured Arwell's face frowning behind his round spectacles. My clothes had been washed and mended. I put them on, moving slowly to savor all the exciting messages my body was sending me. I was glad there wasn't a mirror in the room, knowing I must look completely battered. The bandage around my head was rather irritating, but I decided to leave it on. From the way things felt, it might be the only thing keeping my head from falling into several different pieces. I went to the window. It was overcast, and in the gray light the town looked awful, soot and ash everywhere. The shop across the street had been smashed like a dollhouse under a soldier's boot. People moved about slowly, sifting through the wreckage. The clouds were thick enough that I couldn't tell what time it was. I heard a faint rush of air as the door opened, and I turned to see a young woman standing in the doorway. Young, pretty, unassuming, the sort of girl that always worked at little inns like this. A Nellie. Nell. The sort of girl who spent her life in a perpetual flinch because the innkeeper had a temper and a sharp tongue, and wasn't afraid to show her the back of his hand. She gaped at me, obviously surprised that I was out of bed. "Was anyone killed?" I asked. She shook her head.
"The Lirum boy got his arm broke pretty bad, and some folk got burned and such."
I felt my whole body relax.
"You shouldn't be up, sir. Doctor said you weren't likely to wake up at all. You should rest."
"Has my cousin come back to town?" I asked. "The girl who was out at the Mothin farm. Is she here too?" The young woman shook her head.
"It's just you, sir."
"What time is it?"
"Supper's not quite ready, sir, but I can bring you something if you like."
My travel sack had been left by the side of the bed. I lifted it up onto my shoulder. It felt odd with nothing inside except the scale and lodestone. I looked around for my boots until I remembered I'd kicked them off to get better traction running around the rooftops last night. I left the room with the girl trailing behind me and headed down to the common room. It was the same fellow behind the bar as before, still wearing his scowl. I walked up to him. "My cousin," I said. "Is she in town?"
The barman turned the scowl toward the doorway behind me as the young girl emerged.
Nell! What in God's hell are you doing letting him up? I swear you haven't got the sense God gave a dog!
So her name really was Nell. I would have found that amusing under different circumstances. He turned to me and gave a smile that was really just a different sort of scowl.
Lord, boy, does your face hurt? It's killing me!
He chortled at his own joke. I glared at him. I asked about my cousin. He shook his head.
She hasn't come back. Good riddance to bad luck, I say.
Bring me bread, fruit, and whatever meat you have ready in the back, I said, and a bottle of Avenish fruit wine, strawberry, if you have it. He leaned up against the bar and raised an eyebrow at me. His scowl reshaped itself into a small, patronizing smile.
No sense rushing about, son. The constable will be wanting to talk to you now that you're up.
I clenched my teeth against my first choice of words and took a deep breath. Listen, I've had an exceptionally irritating couple of days. My head hurts in ways you don't have the full wit to understand, and I have a friend who might be in trouble. I stared at him, icy in my calm. I have no desire to have things turn unpleasant, so I'm asking you, kindly, to get me what I asked for. I brought out my purse. Please. He looked at me, anger slowly bubbling up onto his face.
You mouthy little swagger cock! If you don't show me a little respect, I'll sit you down and tie you to a chair until the constable comes.
I tossed an iron drab onto the bar, keeping another clenched tight in my fist. He scowled at it.
What's that?
I concentrated and felt a chill begin to bleed up my arm. That is your tip, I said, as a thin curl of smoke began to curl up from the drab, for your quick and courteous service. The varnish around the drab began to bubble and char in a black ring around the piece of iron. The man stared at it, mute and horrified. Now fetch me what I asked for, I said, looking him in the eye, and a skin of water, too, or I will burn this place down around your ears and dance among the ashes and your charred, sticky bones. I came to the top of the Greystone Hill with my travel sack full. I was barefoot, out of breath, and my head was throbbing. Denna was nowhere to be seen. Making a quick search of the area, I found all my scattered possessions where I'd left them, both blankets. The water skin was mostly empty, but other than that, everything was here. Denna might have just stepped away for a call of nature. I waited. I waited for longer than was entirely sensible. Then I called for her, softly at first, then louder, though my head throbbed when I shouted. Finally, I just sat. All I could think about was Denna waking alone, aching, thirsty, and disoriented. What must she have thought? I ate a little then, trying to think of what I could do next. I considered opening the bottle of wine, but knew it was a bad idea, as I undoubtedly had a mild concussion. I fought off the irrational worry that Denna might have wandered into the woods in a delirium, and that I should go look for her. I considered lighting a fire so she would see it and come back. But no. I knew she was simply gone. She woke, saw that I wasn't there, and left. She had said it herself when we left the inn in Traben. I leave where I'm not wanted. The rest I can make up as I go. Did she think I had abandoned her? Regardless, I knew in my bones that she was long gone from here. I packed up my travel sack. Then, just in case I was wrong, I wrote a note explaining what had happened and that I would wait for her in Traben for a day. I used a piece of coal to write her name on one of the graystones, then drew an arrow down to where I left all the food I had brought, a bottle of water, and one of the blankets. Then I left. My mood was not a pleasant one. My thoughts were not gentle or kind. When I came back to Traben, dusk was closing over the city. I made my way onto the rooftops with a little more care than usual. I wouldn't be able to trust my balance until my head had a few days to mend itself. Still, it was no great feat to make it to the roof of the inn where I collected my boots, From this vantage, in the dim light, the town looked grim. The front half of the church had completely collapsed, and nearly a third of the town had been scarred by fire. Some buildings were merely singed, but others were little more than ash and cinders. Despite my best efforts, the fire must have raged out of control after I was knocked unconscious. I looked to the north and saw the peak of the Greystone Hill. I hoped to see the flicker of a fire, but there was nothing, of course. I made my way over to the flat roof of the town hall and climbed the ladder to the cistern. It was almost empty. A few feet of water rippled near the bottom, far below where my knife pinned a charred shingle to the wall. That explained the state the town was in. When the water level had dropped below my makeshift sigildry, the fire had flared up again. Still, it had slowed things down. If not for that, there might not be any town left at all. Back at the inn, a great many somber, sooty people were gathering to drink and gossip. My scowling friend was nowhere to be seen, but a cluster of folk were gathered around the bar, excitedly discussing something they saw there. The mayor and the constable were there, too. As soon as they spotted me, they rushed me into a private room to talk. I was tight-lipped and grim, and after the events of the last several days, not terribly intimidated by the authority of two paunchy old men. They could tell, and that made them nervous. I had a headache and didn't feel like explaining myself, and was quite comfortable tolerating an uncomfortable silence. Because of this, they talked quite a bit, and in asking their own questions, they told me most of what I wanted to know. The town's injuries were blessedly minor. Because it had been the harvest festival, no one had been caught sleeping. There were a lot of bruises, singed hair, and folk that had breathed more smoke than was good for them, but aside from a few bad burns and the fellow whose arm had been crushed by a falling timber, I looked to have gotten the worst of it. They knew beyond all certainty that the Dracus was a demon, a huge black demon breathing fire and poison. If there had been any slim sliver of doubt as to that fact, it had been laid to rest when the beast had been struck down by Talu's own iron. It was also agreed upon that the demon beast had been responsible for the destruction of the Mothin farm. A reasonable conclusion, despite the fact that it was dead wrong. Trying to convince them of anything else would be a pointless waste of my time. I had been found unconscious atop the iron wheel that had killed the demon. The local sawbone doctor had patched me up as best he could, and, unfamiliar with the remarkable thickness of my skull, expressed serious doubts as to whether or not I would ever wake. At first, the general opinion was that I was merely an unlucky bystander, or that I had somehow pried the wheel off the church. However, my miraculous recovery, combined with the fact that I had charred a hole into the bar downstairs, encouraged people to finally take notice of what a young boy and an old widow had been saying all day, that when the old oak had gone up like a torch, they had seen someone standing on the roof of the church. He was lit by the fire below. His arms were raised in front of him almost as if he were praying. Eventually, the mayor and constable ran out of things to say to fill the silence, and merely sat there, looking anxiously back and forth from me to each other. It occurred to me they didn't see a penniless, ragged boy sitting across from them. They saw a mysterious, battered figure who had killed a demon. I saw no reason to dissuade them. In fact, it was high time I caught a piece of luck in this business. If they considered me some sort of hero or holy man, it gave me useful leverage. "What did you do with the demon's body?" I asked, and watched them relax. Until this point, I had barely spoken a dozen words responding to most of their tentative questions with grim silence.
"Don't worry about that, sir," the constable said. "We knew what to do with it."
My stomach knotted, and I knew before they told me. They'd burned and buried it. The creature was a scientific marvel, and they had burned and buried it like trash. I knew naturalist scribes in the archives who would have cut off their hands to study such a rare creature. I had even hoped, deep in my heart, that bringing such an opportunity to their attention might win me my way back into the archives. And the scales and bones, hundreds of pounds of denatured iron that alchemists would have fought over. The mayor nodded eagerly and sing-songed,
Dig a pit that's 10 by 2, ash and elm and rowan too. He cleared his throat. Though it had to be a bigger hole than that, of course. Everyone took a turn to get it done as quickly as possible.
He held up his hand, proudly displaying a set of fresh blisters. I closed my eyes and fought down the urge to throw things around the room and curse them in 8 languages. That explained why the town was still in such a sorry state. Everyone had been busy burning and burying a creature worth a king's ransom. Still, there was nothing to be done about it. I doubted my new reputation would be enough to protect me if they caught me trying to dig it up. "The girl that survived the Mothin wedding," I said. "Has anyone seen her today?" The mayor looked at the constable questioningly.
"Not that I've heard. Do you think she was connected to the beast in some way?"
"What?" The question was so absurd, I didn't understand it at first. "No! Don't be ridiculous!" I scowled at them. The last thing I needed was to somehow implicate Denna in all this. "She was helping me in my work," I said, careful to keep things ambiguous. The mayor glared at the constable, then looked back to me.
"Is your work finished here?" he asked carefully, as if afraid of giving offense. "I certainly don't mean to pry into your affairs, but..." He licked his lips nervously. "Why did this happen? Are we safe?"
"You're as safe as I can make you," I said ambiguously. It sounded like a heroic thing to say. If all I was going to gain from this was a bit of reputation, I might as well make sure it was the right sort. Then I had an idea. "To be certain of your safety, I need one thing." I leaned forward in my chair, lacing my fingers together. "I need to know what Mothin dug up on Barrow Hill." I saw them look at each other, thinking, "How does he know about that?" I leaned back in the chair, fighting the urge to smile like a tomcat in a dovecote. "If I know what Mothin found up there, I can take steps to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. I know it was a secret, but someone in town is bound to know more. Spread the word, and have anyone who knows anything come talk to me." I came to my feet smoothly. It took a conscious effort not to wince at the various twinges and aches. "But have them come quickly. I leave tomorrow evening. I have pressing business to the south." Then I swept out the door, my cloak trailing rather dramatically behind me. I am a trooper to my bones, and when the scene is set, I know how to make an exit. I spent the next day eating good food and dozing in my soft bed. I took a bath, tended to my various wounds, and generally took a well-deserved rest. A few people stopped by to tell me what I already knew. Mothin had dug up barrow stones and found something buried there. What was it? Just something. No one knew more than that. I was sitting beside my bed, toying with the idea of writing a song about the Dracus, when I heard a timid tapping at my door, so faint I almost missed it.
"Come in."
The door opened a crack, then wider. A young girl of 13 or so looked around nervously and scurried inside, closing the door softly behind her. She had curling, mousy brown hair and a pale face with 2 spots of color high on each cheek. Her eyes were hollow and dark, as if she had been crying or missing sleep, or both.
"You wanted to know what Mothin dug up?"
She looked at me, then away. "What's your name?" I asked gently.
"Verania Greyflock," she said dutifully, then dropped a hurried curtsy, looking at the floor.
"That's a lovely name," I said. "A verain is a tiny red flower." I smiled, trying to set her at ease. "Have you ever seen one?" She shook her head, eyes still on the floor. "I'm guessing no one calls you Verania, though. Are you a Nina?" She looked up at that. A faint smile showed itself on her stricken face.
"That's what my gran calls me."
"Come sit, Nina." I nodded to the bed, as it was the only other place to sit in the room. She sat, her hands twisting nervously in her lap.
"I seen it. The thing they got out of the barrow?"
She looked up at me,
then down at her hands again. "Jimmy, Mothin's youngest boy, he showed me." My heart beat faster.
"What was it?"
"It was a big, fancy pot," she said softly, "about this high."
She held her hand about 3 feet off the ground. It was shaking.
"It had all sorts of writings and pictures on it. Really fancy. I haven't ever seen colors like that. And some of the paints were shiny like silver and gold."
"Pictures of what?" I asked, fighting to keep my voice calm.
"People," she said. "Mostly people. There was a woman holding a broken sword, and a man next to a dead tree, and another man with a dog biting his leg." She trailed off.
"Was there one with white hair and black eyes?" She looked at me wide-eyed, nodded.
"Gave me the all-overs,"
she shivered.
"The Chandrian."
It was a vase showing the Chandrian and their signs. "Can you remember anything else about the pictures?" I asked. "Take your time. Think hard." She thought about it.
"There was one with no face, just a hood with nothing inside. There was a mirror by his feet, and there was a bunch of moons over him. You know, full moon, half moon, sliver moon."
She looked down, thinking.
"And there was a woman," she blushed, "with some of her clothes off."
"Can you remember anything else?" I asked. She shook her head.
"What about the writing?"
Nina shook her head.
"This was all foreign writing. It didn't say anything."
"Do you think you could draw any of the writing you saw on it?" She shook her head again.
"I only saw it for half a moment," she said. "Me and Jimmy knew we'd catch a beating if his dad caught us."
Her eyes welled up with sudden tears.
"Are demons going to be coming for me, too? 'Cause I seen it?"
I shook my head reassuringly, but she burst into tears anyway.
"I've been so scared since what happened out at Mothin's," she sobbed. "I keep having dreams. I know they're going to come and get me."
I moved to sit next to her on the bed and put my arm around her, making comforting noises. Her sobbing slowly wound down. "Nothing is going to come and get you." She looked up at me. She was no longer crying, but I could see the truth of things in her eyes. Underneath it all, she was still terrified. No amount of gentle words would be enough to reassure her. I stood and went over to my cloak. "Let me give you something," I said, reaching into one of the pockets. I brought a piece of the sympathy lamp I was working on in the fishery. It was a disc of bright metal, covered with intricate sigildry on one side. I brought it back to her. "I got this charm when I was in Beloren, far away across the Stormwall Mountains. It is a most excellent charm against demons." I took her hand and pressed it into her palm. Nina looked down at it, then up at me.
"Don't you need it?"
I shook my head. "I have other ways of keeping safe." She clutched it, tears spilling down her cheeks again.
"Oh, thank you. I'll keep it with me all the time."
Her hands were white-knuckled around it. She would lose it. Not soon, but in a year, or two, or 10. It was human nature, and when that happened, she would be even worse off than before. "There's no need for that," I said quickly. "Here's how it works." I took her hand that clutched the piece of metal and wrapped it in my own.
"Close your eyes."
Nina closed her eyes, and I slowly recited the first 10 lines of Ve Valora Sartane. Not very appropriate, really, but it was all I could think of at the time. Tema is an impressive-sounding language, especially if you have a good dramatic baritone, which I did. I finished, and she opened her eyes. They were full of wonder, not tears. "Now it's tuned to you," I said. "No matter what, no matter where it is, it will protect you and keep you safe. You could even break it and melt it down, and the charm would still hold." She threw her arms around me and kissed my cheek, then stood suddenly, blushing. No longer pale and stricken,
Her eyes were bright. I hadn't noticed it before, but she was beautiful. She left soon after that, and I sat for a while on my bed, thinking. Over the last month, I had pulled a woman from a blazing inferno. I had called fire and lightning down on assassins and escaped to safety. I had even killed something that could have been either a dragon or a demon, depending on your point of view. But there in that room was the first time I actually felt like any sort of hero. If you are looking for a reason for the man I would eventually become, if you are looking for a beginning, look there. Chapter 83. Return. That evening, I gathered up my things and made my way down to the common room. The townsfolk eyed me and murmured excitedly among themselves. I overheard a few comments as I walked to the bar and realized that yesterday most of them had seen me wrapped in bandages, presumably with terrible wounds underneath. Today, the bandages were gone, and all they saw were some minor bruises. Another miracle. I fought to keep from smiling. The sullen innkeeper told me that he couldn't possibly dream of charging me, seeing as how the entire town was in my debt and all that. I insisted. No, no, absolutely not. He wouldn't hear of it. If only there was something else he could do to show his gratitude. I put on a thoughtful expression. Now that he mentioned it, I said, if he happened to have another bottle of that lovely strawberry wine. I made my way to Evesdown Docks and got a seat on a barge heading downriver. Then, while I was waiting, I asked if any of the dock workers had seen a young woman come through here in the last couple days. Dark-haired, pretty. They had. She had been by yesterday afternoon and shipped downriver. I felt a certain amount of relief knowing that she was safe and relatively sound. But other than that, I didn't know what to think. Why hadn't she come to Traben? Did she think I'd abandon her? Did she remember anything we had talked about that night as we lay on the Greystone together? We docked in Imray a few hours after dawn, and I went straight away to Debbie's. After some spirited bargaining, I gave her the Lodenstone and a single talent in order to wipe out my extremely short-term loan of 20 talents. I still owed my original debt, but after all I'd been through, a 4-talent debt no longer seemed terribly ominous, despite the fact that my purse was largely empty again. It took a while to put my life back together. I'd only been gone 4 days, but I needed to make apologies and give explanations to all manner of people. I'd missed an appointment with Count Threp, and 2 meetings with Manette, and a lunch with Fella. Anchors had gone without a musician for 2 nights. Even Ari reproached me gently for not coming to visit her. I'd missed classes with Kilvin, Elksadal, and Arwill. They all accepted my apologies with gracious disapproval. I knew that when next term's tuitions were set, I would end up paying for my sudden, largely unexplained absence. Most important were Will and Sim. They had heard rumors of a student attacked in an alley. Given Ambrose's smugger-than-usual expression of late, they expected I had been run out of town, or, at worst, that I was weighted down with rocks at the bottom of the Omephi. They were the only ones that got a real explanation of what had happened. Though I didn't tell them the entire truth about why I was interested in the Chandrian, I did tell them the whole story, and showed them the scale. They were appropriately amazed, though they did tell me in plain terms that next time I would leave a note for them, or they would be hell to pay. And I looked for Denna, hoping to make my most important explanation of all, but, as always, looking did no good. Chapter 84. A Sudden Storm. In the end, I found Denna, as I always do, through pure accident. I was walking hurriedly along, my mind full of other things, when I turned a corner and had to pull up short to keep from running headlong into her. We both stood there for a half second, startled and speechless. Despite the fact that I'd been searching out her face in every shadow and carriage window for days, the sight of her stunned me. I'd remembered the shape of her eyes, but not the weight of them, their darkness, but not their depth. Her closeness pressed the breath out of my chest,
as if I'd suddenly been thrust deep underwater. I'd spent long hours thinking about how this meeting might go. I had played the scene 1,000 times in my mind. I feared she would be distant, aloof, that she would spurn me for leaving her alone in the woods, that she would be silent and sullenly hurt. I worried that she might cry, or curse me, or simply turn and leave. Denna gave me a delighted smile.
Quoth!
She caught up my hand and pressed it between her own.
I've missed you! Where have you been?
I felt myself go weak with relief.
Oh, you know, here and there.
I made a nonchalant gesture. Around.
You left me dry in the dock the other day, she said with a mock serious glare.
I waited, but the tide never came. I was about to explain things to her when Denna gestured to the man standing beside her.
Forgive my rudeness.
Quoth,
this is Lentarin.
I hadn't even noticed him.
Lentarin, quoth.
Lentarin was tall and lean, well-muscled, well-dressed, and well-bred. He had a jawline a mason would have been proud of, and straight, white teeth. He looked like Prince Gallant out of a storybook. He reeked of money. He smiled at me, his manner easy, friendly.
Nice to meet you, Quoth,
he said with a graceful half-bow. I returned the bow on pure reflex, smiling my most charming smile.
At your service, Lentarin.
I turned back to Denna.
We should have lunch one of these days, I said blithely, arching one eyebrow ever so slightly, asking,
is this Master Ash?
I have some interesting stories for you.
Absolutely. She shook her head slightly, telling me, no. You left before you could finish your last one. I was terribly disappointed that I missed the end. Distraught, in fact.
Oh, it's just the same thing you've heard before, 100 times before, I said. Prince Gallant kills the dragon, but loses the treasure and the girl.
Ah, a tragedy. Denna looked down. Not the ending I'd hoped for, but no more than I expected, I suppose.
It would be something of a tragedy if it stopped there, I admitted. But it depends on how you look at it, really.
I prefer to think of it as a story that's waiting for an appropriately uplifting sequel. A carriage trundled by on the road, and Lentarin stepped out of the way, incidentally brushing up against Denna as he moved. She took hold of his arm absent-mindedly.
I don't generally go in for serial stories, she said, her expression momentarily serious and unreadable.
Then she shrugged and gave me a hint of a wry smile. But I've certainly changed my mind about these things before. Maybe you'll convince me otherwise.
I gestured to the loot case I carried slung over my shoulder. I still play at Anchors most nights, if you'd like to stop in.
I will. Denna sighed and looked up at Lentarin.
We're already late, aren't we?
He squinted up at the sun and nodded.
We are, but we can still catch them if we hurry.
She turned back to me. I'm sorry, we have a riding appointment.
I would never dream of keeping you, I said, graciously stepping to one side, out of their way.
Lentarin and I nodded politely to each other.
I'll come find you before too long, she said, turning to face me as they walked past.
Go on, I nodded in the direction they'd been heading. Don't let me keep you.
They turned to go. I watched them walk through the cobbled streets of Imre, together.
Will and Sim were waiting for me by the time I arrived. They had already claimed a bench with a good view of the fountain in front of the Aeolian. Water flared up around statuary nymphs being chased by a satyr. I laid my loot case down beside the bench and absent-mindedly flipped open the lid, thinking my lute might enjoy the feel of a little sun on its strings. If you aren't a musician, I don't expect you to understand. Will handed me an apple as I took a seat next to them. The wind brushed through the square, and I watched the spray from the fountain move like gauzy curtains in the wind. A few red maple leaves danced circles on the cobblestones. I watched them as they skipped and twirled, tracing strange, complicated patterns in the empty air.
I'm guessing you finally found Dana,
Willem asked after a while. I nodded without looking away from the leaves. I didn't really feel like explaining.
I can tell because you're quiet, he said.
Didn't go well? Sim asked gently. Didn't turn out the way I'd hoped, I said. They nodded sagely, and there was another moment of silence.
I was thinking about what you told us, Will said. What your Dana said. There is a hole in her story.
Sim and I looked at him, curious.
She said she was looking for her patron, Willem pointed out. She was traveling with you to look for him. But later, she said she knew he was safe because he...
Will hesitated significantly.
Met with her as she was heading back to the burning farm. It does not fit. Why would she hunt for him if she knew he was safe?
I hadn't considered that. Before I could think of a response, Simon shook his head. She was just making an excuse to spend time with him, he said, as if it were plain as day. Willem frowned a little. Sim looked back and forth between us, plainly surprised he had to explain himself. It's obvious she has a thing for you, he said, and began counting on his fingers. She found you at Anchor's. She comes to get you that night at Aeolian when we're drinking. She makes up an excuse to wander around the middle of nowhere with you for a couple of days. Sim, I said exasperated, if she was interested, I'd be able to find her more than once in a month of searching. That's a logical fallacy, Sim pointed out eagerly. False cause. All that proves is that you're lousy at finding her, or that she's hard to find, not that she's not interested.
In fact, Willem pointed out, taking up Simmons' side, since she finds you more often, it seems likely that she must spend a fair amount of time looking for you. You are not easy to track down. That indicates interest.
I thought about the note she had left me, and for a moment I entertained the thought that Sim might be right. I felt a faint hope flicker in my chest, remembering that night we lay atop the Greystone. Then I remembered that Dena had been delirious out of her mind that night, and I remembered Dena on Lentarin's arm. I thought of tall, handsome, wealthy Lentarin and all the other countless men who had something worthwhile to offer her. Something more than a good singing voice and manly bravado. You know I'm right. Simon pushed his hair out of his eyes, laughing boyishly. You can't argue your way out of this one. She's obviously stupid for you, and you're just plain stupid, so it's a great match. I sighed. Sim, I'm happy to have her as a friend. She's a delightful person, and I'm glad to spend time with her. That's all there is. I forced the proper amount of jovial unconcern into my voice so Sim would take me at my word and drop the subject for the time being. Sim looked at me for a moment and shrugged it off.
If that's the case, he said, gesturing with his piece of chicken, Fella talks about you all the time. Thinks you're a hell of a guy, plus the whole saving her life thing. I'm pretty sure you have a chance there.
I shrugged. Watching the patterns the wind made in the fountain's spray.
You know what we should...
Sim stopped mid-thought, staring past me, his expression going suddenly blank. I turned to see what he was looking at, and saw my loot case, empty. My loot was gone. I looked around wildly, ready to spring to my feet and dash off searching for it, but there was no need. A few feet away stood Ambrose and a few of his friends. He held my lute loosely in one hand. Oh, merciful Talu, Simon muttered behind me. Then, at a normal volume, he said, Give it back, Ambrose.
Quiet, Ilir, Ambrose snapped. This is none of your concern.
I got to my feet, keeping my eyes on him, on my lute. I had come to think of Ambrose as taller than me, but when I stood, I saw that we were eye level with each other. Ambrose seemed a bit surprised as well. Give it to me, I said, and stretched out my hand. I was surprised to see that it wasn't shaking. I was shaking inside, half fear, half fury. Two parts of me tried to speak at the same time, The first cried, "Please don't do anything to it. Not again. Don't break it. Please give it back. Don't hold it by the neck like that." The other half of me was chanting, "I hate you. I hate you. I hate you," like spitting out mouthfuls of blood. I took a step forward. "Give it to me." My voice sounded odd to my own ears, emotionless and flat. Flat as my outstretched palm. I had stopped shaking inside. He paused for a moment, caught unaware by something in my tone. I could sense his unease. I wasn't acting the way he had expected. Behind me, I could hear Willem and Simon hold their breath. Behind Ambrose, his friends paused, suddenly unsure. Ambrose smiled and cocked an eyebrow. "But I've written a song for you, and it needs to be accompanied." He gripped the lute roughly and dragged his fingers across the strings with no thought for rhythm or tune. People stopped to watch as he sang. "There once was a ravel named Quoth, whose tongue was quick as quipping. The masters thought him clever and rewarded him with whipping." A few passers-by had stopped to watch by this point, smiling and laughing at Ambrose's little show. Encouraged, Ambrose made a sweeping bow. "Everyone sing!" he shouted, raising his hands like an orchestra conductor, gesturing with my lute like a baton. I took another step forward. "Give it back, or I will kill you." At that moment, I meant it in perfect earnest. Everything grew quiet again. Seeing he wasn't going to get the rise he had expected from me, Ambrose affected nonchalance. "Some people have no sense of humor," he said with a sigh. "Catch!" He tossed it to me, but lutes are not meant to be tossed. It twisted awkwardly in the air, and when I grabbed, there was nothing in my hands. Whether he was clumsy or cruel makes not the slightest difference to me. My lute hit the cobblestones bowl first and made a splintering noise. The sound reminded me of the terrible noise my father's lute had made, crushed beneath my body in a soot-streaked alley in Tarbian. I bent to pick it up, and it made a noise like a wounded animal. Ambrose half turned to look back at me, and I saw flickers of amusement play across his face. I opened my mouth to howl, to cry, to curse him. But something other tore from my throat, a word I did not know and could not remember. Then all I could hear was the sound of the wind. It roared into the courtyard like a sudden storm. A nearby carriage slid sideways across the cobblestones, its horses rearing up in panic. Sheet music was torn from someone's hands to streak around us like strange lightning. I was pushed forward a step. Everyone was pushed by the wind. Everyone but Ambrose, who pinwheeled to the ground as if struck by the hand of God. Then everything was still again. Papers fell, twisting like autumn leaves. People looked around, dazed, their hair tousled and clothes in disarray. Several people staggered as they braced against a storm that was no longer there. My throat hurt. My lute was broken. Ambrose staggered to his feet. He held his arm awkwardly at his side, and blood was running down from his scalp. The look of wild, confused fear he gave me was a brief, sweet pleasure. I considered shouting at him again, wondering what would happen. Would the wind come again? Would the ground swallow him up? I heard a horse whinnying in panic. People began to pour from the Aeolian and the other buildings around the courtyard. Musicians looked around wildly, and everyone was talking at once. "Was that... notes are all over. Help me before they get..." "Did it? Him over there, with the red. Demon, a demon of wind and..." I looked around in mute confusion until Willem and Simon hurried me away. "We didn't know where to take him," Simon said to Kilvin.
"Say it all to me again," Kilvin said calmly. "But this time, only one talks." He pointed at Willem. "Try to put the words all in a tidy row."
We were in Kilvin's office. The door was closed and the curtains drawn. Willem began to explain what had happened. As he gained speed, he switched to Ciaru. Kilvin kept nodding along, his face thoughtful. Simon listened intently, occasionally interjecting a word or two. I sat on a stool nearby. My mind was a whirl of confusion and half-formed questions. My throat was sore. My body was weary and full of sour adrenaline. In the middle of it all, deep in the center of my chest, a piece of me burned in anger like a forged coal fanned red and hot. All around me there was a great numbness, as if I were sealed in wax 10 inches thick. There was no quoth, only the confusion, the anger, and the numbness wrapping them. I was like a sparrow in a storm, unable to find a safe branch to cling to, unable to control the tumbling motion of my flight. Willem was reaching the end of his explanation when Elodin entered the room without knocking or announcing himself. Willem fell silent. I spared the master namer half a glance, then looked back toward the shattered lute in my hands. As I turned it over in my hands, one of its sharp edges cut my finger. I blankly watched the blood well up and fall to the floor. Elodin came to stand directly in front of me, not bothering to speak to anyone else. Quoth,
"He's not right, Master," Simon said, his voice shrill with worry. "He's gone all dumb. He won't say a thing."
While I heard the words, knew they had meaning, even knew the meanings that belonged to them, I couldn't pull any sense from them.
"I think he struck his head," Willem said. "He looks at you, but nothing is there. His eyes are like a dog's eyes."
"Quoth?" Elodin repeated. When I didn't respond or look up from my lute, he reached forward and gently tipped my chin up until I met his eye. "Quoth?" I blinked. He looked at me. His dark eyes steadied me somewhat, slowed the storm inside me. "Erlev Seti," he said. "Say it."
"What?"
Simon said somewhere in the distant background.
"Wind?"
"Erlev Seti," Elodin repeated patiently, his dark eyes intent upon my face.
"Erlev Seti,"
I said numbly. Elodin closed his eyes briefly, peacefully, as if he were trying to catch a faint strain of music wafting gently on a breeze. Unable to see his eyes, I began to drift. I looked back down toward the broken lute in my hands, but before my gaze wandered too far, he caught my chin again, tilting my face up. His eyes caught mine. The numbness faded, but the storm still turned inside my head. Then Elodin's eyes changed. He stopped looking toward me and looked into me. That is the only way I can describe it. He looked deep into me, not into my eyes, but through my eyes. His gaze went into me and settled solidly in my chest, as if he had both his hands inside me, feeling the shape of my lungs, the movement of my heart, the heat of my anger, and the pattern of the storm that thundered inside me. He leaned forward, and his lips brushed my ear. I felt his breath. He spoke, and the storm stilled. I found a place to land. There is a game all children try at some time or another. You fling out your arms and spin round and round, watching as the world blurs. First, you are disoriented, but if you continue to spin long enough, the world resolves itself, and you are no longer dizzy as you spin with the world blurring around you. Then you stop, and the world lurches into regular shape. The dizziness strikes you like a thunderclap. Everything lurches, moves. The world tilts around you. That is what happened when Elodin stilled the storm in my head. Suddenly, violently dizzy, I cried out and raised my hands to keep myself from falling sideways, falling upward, falling inward. I felt arms catch me as my feet tangled in the stool, and I began to topple to the floor. It was terrifying, but it faded. By the time I recovered, Elodin was gone. Chapter 85. Hands Against Me. Simon and Willem took me to my room at Anchors, where I fell into bed and spent 18 hours behind the doors of sleep. When I woke the next day, I felt surprisingly good,
considering I had slept in my clothes and my bladder felt stretched to the size of a sweet melon. Fortune smiled on me, giving me enough time for a meal and a bath before one of Jameson's errand boys tracked me down. I was needed in the master's hall. I was due to be on the horns in half an hour. Ambrose and I stood before the master's table. He had accused me of malfeasance. In retaliation, I had accused him of theft, destruction of property, and conduct unbecoming a member of the Arcanum. After my previous experience on the horns, I had familiarized myself with the Rerum Codex, the university's official rules. I had read them twice to be certain of how things were done around here. I knew them like the backs of my hands. Unfortunately, this meant I knew exactly how much trouble I was in. The charge of malfeasance was a serious one. If they found me guilty of intentionally harming Ambrose, I would be whipped and expelled from the university. There was little doubt that I had hurt Ambrose. He was bruised and limping. A garish red abrasion colored his forehead. He wore a sling as well, but I was fairly certain that was merely a piece of drama he had added on his own. The trouble was, I didn't have the slightest idea what had really happened. I hadn't had the opportunity to speak with anyone, not even to thank Elodin for helping me yesterday in Kilvin's shop. The masters allowed each of us to speak our piece. Ambrose was on his best behavior, which meant he was very polite when he spoke at all. After a while, I began to suspect that his sluggishness might be from a too liberal dose of painkiller. By the glaze in his eyes, my guess was laudanum. "Let's deal with the grievances in order of their severity," the Chancellor said after we had related our sides of the story. Master Hem made a gesture, and the Chancellor nodded for him to speak.
"We should pare the charges down before we vote," Hem said. "Ilirkvul's complaints are redundant. You cannot charge a student with both theft and destruction of the same property. It's either one or the other."
"Why do you say that, Master?" I asked politely.
"Theft implies the possession of another's property," Hem said in reasonable tones. "How can you possess something that you have destroyed? One charge or the other should be set aside."
The Chancellor looked at me. "Ilirkvoth, do you wish to set aside one of your complaints?"
"No, sir."
"Then I call for a vote to set aside the charge of theft," Hem said.
The Chancellor glared at Hem, chastising him silently for speaking out of turn, then turned back to me. "Stubbornness in the face of reason is hardly laudable, Ilir. And Master Hem makes a convincing argument."
"Master Hem makes a flawed argument," I said evenly. "Theft implies acquisition of another's property. It is ridiculous to imply that you cannot destroy what you have stolen."
I saw a few of the masters nod at this, but Hem persisted.
"Master Lauren, what is the punishment for theft?"
"The student may be given no more than 2 single lashes across the back," Lauren recited, "and must return the property or the price of the property plus a fine of 1 silver talent.
"And the punishment for destruction of property?"
"The student must pay for the replacement or repair of the property."
"You see," Hem said, "there is the possibility that he would have to pay twice for the same loot. There is no justice in that. It would be punishing him twice for the same thing."
"No, Master Hem," I interjected. "It would be punishing him for theft and for destruction of property." The Chancellor gave me the same look Hem had earned before for speaking out of turn, but I bowled ahead. "If I had lent him my loot and he had broken it, that would be one matter. If he had stolen it and left it intact, that would be another. But it is not one or the other. It's both."
The Chancellor rapped his knuckles on the table to quiet us.
"I take it, then, that you will not set aside one of the charges."
"I will not."
Hem raised a hand and was recognized.
"I call for a vote to strike the charge of theft."
"All in favor?" the Chancellor said wearily. Hem raised his hand, as did Brandur, Mandrag, and Lauren. 5.5-4, grievance stands. The Chancellor pressed on before anyone could slow things down.
Who finds Relar Ambrose guilty of destruction of property?
Everyone raised their hands but Hem and Brandur. The Chancellor looked at me.
How much did you pay for your loot?
9 talents and 6, I lied, knowing it to be a reasonable price.
Ambrose roused himself at this. Come now! You've never held 10 talents in your life!
Annoyed, the Chancellor rapped his knuckles at the interruption, but Brandur raised a hand to speak.
Relar Ambrose does raise an interesting point. How does a student who came to us destitute come by such money?
A few of the masters looked at me speculatively. I looked down as if embarrassed. I won it playing corners, sir. There was an amused mutter. Elodin laughed out loud. The Chancellor rapped the table.
Relar Ambrose to be fined 9 talents and 6. Does any master oppose this action?
Hem raised his hand and was voted down.
On the grievance of theft, number of lashes sought?
None, I said, raising a few eyebrows.
Who finds Relar Ambrose guilty of theft? The Chancellor called out.
Hem, Brandur, and Lauren kept their hands down.
Relar Ambrose to be fined 10 talents and 6. Does any master oppose this action?
Hem kept his hand down this time, looking sullen. The Chancellor took a deep breath and let it out in a rush.
Master Archivist, what is the punishment for conduct unbecoming a member of the Arcanum?
Student may be fined, lashed, suspended from the Arcanum, or expelled from the university, depending on the severity of grievance, Lauren said calmly.
Punishment sought?
Suspension from the Arcanum, I said, as if it were the most sensible thing in the world. Ambrose's composure broke.
What?
He said incredulously, turning to face me. Hem chimed in.
Herma, this is growing ridiculous.
The Chancellor looked at me with a tinge of reproach. I am afraid I must agree with Master Hem, Ilir Kvoth. I hardly think that this is grounds for suspension.
I disagree, I said, attempting to bring all my powers of persuasion to bear. Think on what you've heard. For no other reason than his personal distaste for me, Ambrose chose to publicly mock me, then steal and destroy the only thing I owned of any value. Is this the sort of behavior that a member of the Arcanum should exhibit? Is this the attitude you wish to cultivate in the rest of the Relar? Are petty meanness and spite characteristics you approve of in students who seek to become Arcanists? It has been 200 years since we have seen an Arcanist burned. If you succeed in giving guilders to petty children such as this, I gestured to Ambrose, that long-standing peace and safety will be over in a scant handful of years. It swayed them. I could see it on their faces. Ambrose moved nervously beside me, his eyes darting from face to face. After a moment of silence, the Chancellor called for the vote. Those in favor of suspension for Relar Ambrose?
Arwill's hand went up, followed by Lauren's, Elodin's, Elxadal's. There was a tense moment. I looked from Kilvin to the Chancellor, hoping to see one of their hands join the others. The moment passed.
Grievance failed.
Ambrose let out a breath. I was only slightly disappointed. In fact, I was rather surprised I had managed to carry it as far as I had.
Now, the Chancellor said, as if preparing himself for a great effort. The grievance of malfeasance against Ilir Kvoth.
From 4 to 15 single lashes and mandatory expulsion from the university, Lauren recited.
Lashes sought?
Ambrose turned to look at me. I could see the wheels in his mind turning, trying to calculate how heavy a price he could make me pay and still have the master's vote in his favor.
6.
I felt a leaden fear settle into the pit of my stomach. I didn't care one whit about the lashes. I would take 2 dozen if it would keep me from being expelled. If I were thrown from the university, my life was over.
Chancellor, I said.
He gave me a tired, kindly look. His eyes said he understood, but that he had no choice but to see things through to their natural end. The general pity in his look frightened me,
he knew what was going to happen.
"Yes, Ilir Kvothe?"
"Might I say a few things?"
"You have already given your defense," he said firmly.
"But I don't even know what I did!"
I burst out, panic overwhelming my composure.
6 lashes and expulsion,"
the Chancellor carried on in an official voice, ignoring my outburst.
"All those in favor?"
Hem raised his hand. Brandur and Arwill followed. My heart sank as I saw the Chancellor raise his hand, and Lauren, and Kilvin, and Alxadal. Last of all was Elodin, who smiled lazily and waggled the fingers of his upraised hand, as if waving. All 9 hands against me. I was to be expelled from the university. My life was over.